live from the WGN Skyline Studios, high above Columbus and Wacker Drive. It's me, Anna D. Anna DeVlantis, thanks for being with us. So we are supposed to have the all-important Iowa caucus results. Usually we have them by now, but at this point in time...
Usually people have forgotten them by now.
Right, they've moved on. The candidates are already in New Hampshire. Right?
Yeah.
And instead, we're still waiting. We're still waiting. They're efforting them, as they like to say in the broadcast news, but we're efforting that. When they got something jammed in a tape machine or the digital thing is like jamming up.
The best man at my wedding lives in Des Moines, so we were texting all night last night, you know, and he caucused for one candidate who wasn't viable, and then he moved over to another candidate, and we're going back and forth, and like at 9 o'clock, I'm like, what's going on? And finally, we both said, well, you know, this is crazy. We're going to bed. And he said, I think I just participated in the last Iowa caucus.
You know, that is...
And I think he's probably right.
That is such a good point. It is such an issue. There have been so many calls in the past to kind of re-examine Iowa being first. And now this has sort of renewed that whole debate because you talk about the demographics of Iowa being
right.
more rural, being more white, an aging population. Is it representative of the country? I don't know. I mean, it just seemed every time it was brought up, there was so much pushback and things just sat the way
well,
they were.
And there really are parallel arguments. There's that one, which is, you know, a very legitimate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is just the process of this of the caucus. I mean, they've had trouble. They had trouble with Rick Santorum for the Republican side a couple of cycles ago. The Hillary-Bernie thing was kind of fouled up last time. And Claire McCaskill, a former Missouri senator, said something that really hit it on the head yesterday. I was watching her on MSNBC. She goes, look, we're Democrats. We're about making it easier for people to vote. And these caucuses make it hard for people to participate. It's kind of contrary to what we should be standing for. And I think that could be the killing argument for this.
Yeah, there certainly are a number of killing arguments, more so than you typically see every year. You kind of hear these arguments surface around this time.
Which
but
is too
year.
Bad, because I like it. I mean, I like the idea that you stand up in front of someone and, you know, speak your mind and you're trying to persuade others. I think it's a great exercise, but I just don't think it's serving the party very well right now, or the country. I mean, it's the same for the Republicans.
And did you hear this? There is a push from high political powers within our state. We're going to have a guest, Shia Kappas from Politico, come up and talk about this. Governor Pritzker and many others are saying, why not, if not Iowa, why not here in Illinois?
Well, I was in the elevator with Shia, so I can't wait to hear that. But we were having this very conversation today, Grzanich and I were, because if, you know, well, which is the best state, the most representative of the country, what should be first? I think South Carolina's African-American population is higher than typical, so maybe that's tilted the wrong way. And Grzanich said that. He said maybe Illinois is the right state.
Well, and after you saw what happened the last election, sort of this flyover country that was ignored, or there were charges that the candidates didn't pay enough attention, Hillary Clinton in particular, maybe the Midwest is the place where it should be. Maybe this should be it.
We certainly have significant minority populations, but not overwhelming. We have urban, we have substantial rural areas. I wonder what the most representative state in the country is. Maybe you could make a case for Illinois.
Yeah, and the governor certainly is, so are other states. Official Senator Durbin even was saying, look, this is kind of broken now. I think we've proven that this year. I mean, this was outrageous, right?
Yeah, and my buddy from Iowa this morning sent me a picture of a dumpster fire.
That sums it up.
So the party says they're not even going to say they're having all the results, but they're going to have maybe a majority of the results coming in about 3 hours from now, around 4 o'clock our time. So we'll see. But you know, it's just, if I can, it's just sad because so many people, candidates and others, devoted so much time in this, and it's really, it's wasted now because if you're Pete Buttigieg or Bernie Sanders or any of them, it was all about giving the speech last night and building momentum from there now. That the opportunity to build on that is gone. I mean, the delegates may or may not matter in the end, but, you know, that big shot, that slingshot forward sort of thing is missing. And I just think of the people who worked so long on this.
And the money that was spent in Iowa and the ground, you know, troops on the ground and
right.
the people who built the organizations there and did it the way you're supposed to do it in order to really capture the hearts and minds of voters. It sort of went against them in the end because of that.
It could work out for Joe Biden if he wasn't going to do very well because you know, people are not going to pay as much results or attention to the results.
Did you see the Mayor Pete kind of claiming victory last night? Need to little clarify that today. All the journalists are saying, what do you mean by you're victorious?
Yeah.
Did you hear that?
Well, they released, I think, the most complete set of numbers. Sanders released them, too. They had, but he had more precincts. Buttigieg did. But, you know, think of that, too. What a moment that would have been. A gay man winning a major party's state primary.
Mm-hmm.
It may well still happen. But you're not going to bask in it the way you would have.
But do you give that victory speech? I mean, I think you can read it in a number of ways, but a lot of people read it as a victory speech. That he was saying the numbers are there, our data, our internal polling, we have, and he used the word victorious.
We're victorious. Yeah, we're victorious tonight. Well, I mean, if he's confident in his numbers, then it would work for him, I guess. But if it turns out... Yeah, why not? Go for it. If you're wrong, who's going to remember at this point?
Well, the internet has already remembered he's wrong, or at least that he doesn't know yet and can't possibly make that claim, because trending at this moment, hashtag Mayor Cheat.
Oh,
Mayor
nice.
Cheat, that's his new name from the internet, courtesy of folks who like to go after these issues, and take issue with these things in a major way. They don't like the fact that he did that last night, because I think some people might have just sort of, you know, looked through the headlines and say, oh, okay, Pete Buttigieg won. Wow. When there is no victor, right? We don't know anything, do we, Pete? I mean, do we right now, Steve?
No, they're going to release them in a few hours, some of them at least. But I think, you know, a lot of times politicians will claim victory based on their numbers or projections from networks or things like that. He'll be okay if it turns out he's right.
Yeah, if it turns out he's right, I guess. Okay. So this was an app, a mobile app that was used by the Democrats this year.
And don't ask the people in Nevada about it, because they don't want to talk about it.
Oh, have we tried to track the Nevada people down?
Well, because they have a caucus system as well, and apparently are using, if not the same app, a similar one.
Oh, they might want to rethink that.
Well, they say they're very confident things will work out.
Okay. Well, we wish them the best, and we wish Illinois the best, too, because, like I said, Shia Kappas is here from Politico, and she's going to explain about the push to try to make Illinois the first primary state. So instead of Iowa going first, why not Illinois? What are the arguments for and against? And is this just another year where we're hearing these arguments, or could something actually happen? We'll get to Shia and much more here coming up on WGN Radio.
What a night! Because tonight, an improbable hope became an undeniable reality. So we don't know all the results. But we know by the time it's all said and done, Iowa, you have shocked the nation. By all indications, we are going on to New Hampshire victorious.
There it was. He used the word victorious there, Mayor Pete, last night.
Yeah,
and
I'm going to quibble with that a little bit, because he said by all indications, you know. So,
but what are the indications?
Well, by his polling numbers and then what he got from his people in the precincts. You know, they had someone in every precinct as well.
He did. He spent a lot of time, a lot of money in Iowa. But
I'm going to give Pete a pass.
You give Pete a pass. He's not Mayor Cheat to you, I suppose. I think that was a little strong. Anyway, I agree with you on that. But I think he was doing a lot of clarification this morning. He was on the morning national news shows and stuff like that, because they thought, I don't know, what you mean there? And maybe you're right. Maybe he's saying, look, our internal polling, what we're looking at is showing that I won. We still don't know who the winner is. As we mentioned at the top of the show, Steve Bertrand's going to track that for you. And as soon as we get those official results, thinking like what, around 4 o'clock? Is that what you said?
Yeah, that's some of the results.
Some. Now, okay.
Elizabeth Warren is saying, we'll hold off. Let's release all the results at the same time. But I think the party in Iowa is desperate to get something, some good news out behind them.
Get something out right before just New Hampshire takes center stage. It kind of already is. All right. Shia Kappas is center stage here in the studio with us.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Always good to see you. She writes the hands down best rundown of all things political in our area, the Politico Illinois Playbook, and you can go to Politico and find her. You can sign up for her newsletter, all kinds of stuff. You've been covering this, the no clear winner in Iowa, yep. And what I also love is that you have the local take about Illinois officials, the governor and others, jumping on to say, you know what, it's time we just say enough and is enough, no more Iowa, starting off this whole nominating process. We should have it in Illinois.
Right.
A little self-serving, but what are they saying?
Well, and Governor Pritzker was tweeting about this before we even knew that Iowa had stumbled in presenting the caucuses. So he was out there tweeting last night, I think 9 o'clock, saying, you know, Illinois would be a much better state to be having a primary or caucus, I guess, first, for a number of reasons. And he retweeted a story that was published 4 years ago, a study that looked and figured out based on race, age, household income, religion of different states, and Illinois came out number one because we hit all of the right spots in what the country should look like.
Oh, that's interesting. So they've done this study, and they did say that the demographics of Illinois would be representative of the nation.
Right.
That's one of the concerns, not all of them.
Right. Well, look at Chicago alone. It's a third white, a third African American, a third Latino. I mean, you can't get more diverse than Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And then rural communities. We have
rural
urban communities.
Urban. We have manufacturing. We have farming.
Agriculture, right.
You know, there's this thinking that it would be a much better slice of the bigger American pie to look at Illinois than any other state. And so he was saying that before all of this fiasco happened in Iowa. And as a result of Iowa and the caucuses, that's one of the, you know, the debates going on right now, whether they should switch to a different state or whether Iowa should start doing a primary instead of a caucus.
Mm-hmm.
A caucus is kind of quaint and cute because it's real people voting on paper and
trying to convince their others in their community to come over to their side if they don't get that 15% threshold.
Right.
And there's all these rules about it just, you know, that's funny because Senator Dick Durbin said the Iowa caucus, he was quoted on this, he gave a lot of interviews. He doesn't like it either, having the start in Iowa. It's a quirky, quaint tradition which should come to an end, Senator Dick Durbin says. As we try to make voting easier for people across America, the Iowa caucus is the most painful situation we currently face in voting. I wonder if that was before or after. That was this morning, so it was after this whole thing broke there. Even in Iowa, one of their longtime political affairs kind of voices, his name is David Yepsen.
Right.
He talked about how it's hard to see, this is his quote, it's hard to see how Iowa keeps this after last night.
But he's a Saluki now, I think, isn't he?
Is he a Saluki?
I think he works for SIU now. So,
we should be worried about him?
He's come over to
cautious?
Our side.
It's not going to happen easily. Apparently, Iowa has a law that says the caucuses in Iowa must happen before the New Hampshire primary. The law says Iowa must be first. So, I mean, who's to say whether Illinois has our, you know, whether we create our own law and trump the Iowa law. So
I just wonder, you're right, because it's an Iowa, it's a state law. So you just wonder if it really has legs, if this will do it. Because there were some problems last year in Iowa, four years ago.
Yeah, 4 years ago. It was also late, and Hillary barely edged Bernie at the time. And I think Bernie complained a lot about conspiracy theories related to the caucuses, and he's been quiet this time, probably because he realizes that could come back around to hurt him. And now we have to wonder whether Buttigieg, you know, whether his confidence will play out in the actual result, because if it doesn't, that could hurt him too.
Yeah, it is fascinating stuff. I get the sense that this is one of those issues that there'll be a lot of complaining about, and as Steve even mentioned earlier, we'll kind of forget about this in a little, like a couple weeks. We'll be on to New Hampshire
Days to New Hampshire, right? Isn't it?
Yeah, it is 7 days.
7 days, yeah.
Candidates are already there. You see Elizabeth Warren on the ground, and the others are already speaking in New Hampshire, and they've moved on. And I'm sure the country will, too. I just wonder if there will ever be a revisiting of this, if anything would ever happen with it. What would you be your guess on that, Chia?
Okay. Sure. There's going to be lots of revisiting, and I'm sure this will be the subject of discussions when the DCCC meets in private to figure out what to do in 4 years. I imagine this will be center of a lot of debates.
The downside about Illinois, though, because it's fascinating, but the votes are still in the Chicago area. So even though there's a large rural contingency, they wouldn't necessarily need to be heard in order for the candidates to win the state.
That's a good point.
That is a good point. That is a good point. Well, I mean, we'll see. We'll see what happens there. And in just a couple hours here, we'll see what happens in Iowa. We'll get the results there and see if Mayor Pete gets it. It'd be kind of an upset, I would think, if he did. It seemed the polling, at least, and the expectations were that Bernie might be victorious there, or maybe even Biden.
I think it would have been, Bernie was expected to win. I think Biden would be a surprise. I think Buttigieg would be a surprise. And who knows, you know, maybe Amy Klobuchar's did better than we might have expected. She needs to come in one, two, or three to really continue viability, I think, in her campaign. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, okay, 480. Anna, that was mean of you to call Pete Buttigieg Mayor Cheat. I didn't call him Mayor Cheat. The internet is calling him Mayor Cheat. If you go online, it's trending right now because people are feeling as if there was something wrong with the way he presented it. I think
he jumped the gun a little bit.
That's yeah. Right. I do want to get to one other thing because the mayor, Mayor Lori Lightfoot, will be at the State of the Union address tonight.
Right. Mayor Lori Lightfoot has been very low-key about this. She was invited by Congresswoman Robin Kelly. They are allies. Robin Kelly was an early supporter of Mayor Lightfoot when she was running for office a year ago. And that was seen as a big deal because, you know, so many establishment Democrats were backing Tony Preckwinkle at that time and other Democrats before the runoff. So Congresswoman Kelly has been with Lori Lightfoot from the beginning, and now they remain allies, and she's invited the mayor to sit with dignitaries to watch the State of the Union.
Now, so in the past, she did meet with Ivanka and has done that sort of thing, but this visit probably not.
Yeah. The past, when she was in Washington, D.C. a week, 2 weeks ago, she did not go with the mayor. She was with the mayor's convention, and a bunch of them went to see President Trump, and she declined just because President Trump has said so many, awful things about Chicago. She didn't want to.
She's taken issue and got in that private, that personal Twitter war with the president. Right. So it does feel as if this visit will not be about that kind of a thing, but it'll be making a presence nonetheless. Shia Kappas, thank you so much. How can people sign up for your newsletter or read what you do every day?
I know. It's always kind of complicated.
It is.
You have to go
find it, though. It's worth
Politico.
It.
Yeah,
it's
go
worth
to Politico,
it.
Search my name, and then as soon as you, or even Google me, if you search Shia Kappas,
K-A-P-O-S.
Right. And it pops up, and there's a little box. You just put your email in, and then you subscribe.
Let's go, go, go. And it's worth it. Thank you, Shia.
Thank
always
you.
Good to see you. More to come here on WGN Radio. We are going to go to Iowa, check in and see what's happening on the ground there. We have a Nexstar affiliate reporter who will talk with us. And also, Mike Tobin, you know him from the Fox News Channel. They're there in Iowa. They've been witnessing what has happened overnight. I imagine they're operating on very little sleep, but they're nice enough to call in to the show, and we'll be talking with them coming up. All right, we've been talking about Iowa. Thank you, Steve. And let's go to Iowa. Mike Tobin, he's based in Chicago, but he's an international correspondent. You see him on the Fox News Channel. And he's currently in Iowa, the center of the political universe. Mike, I know you've covered a lot of this stuff before. Have you ever seen anything quite like this before?
Not like this, but it's a lot more fun when it goes off script. Otherwise, it's just people, you know, going to polling locations in silly hats, and then we get a result and move on to New Hampshire. So right now, it's kind of interesting, and we're all pretty excited to see what comes out at 4 o'clock. But the disappointing part about that is it's going to be an incomplete result.
Right.
Still.
And so, then when will the complete result come about? Any indication about that?
They haven't given us any indication about that at all. And most of what we're getting in little nuggets is coming from the representatives of these campaigns who are being invited onto these different conference calls. And we bother those guys and get, you didn't hear this from me. And then one of those guys leaks what happens in the calls. So those are the nuggets that we're getting along the way. And a couple of, frankly, cryptic statements from the Iowa Democrat Party. This isn't a real shining moment for the Democratic Party of Iowa. And they're not banging the drum too loudly about it.
I think it's kind of funny that Joe Biden says they should take as long as they need.
He's like...
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting because it doesn't look like Biden necessarily did that well.
Right.
If you look at the numbers that were just released by the Sanders camp, Biden didn't reach viability. So he would like to have the perception of momentum, I guess, if he doesn't have momentum. But it seems like Buttigieg and Sanders got robbed. that they could have some momentum going into New Hampshire. And Buttigieg, in particular, I think he really needs that momentum, because things likely will get worse for him as he gets to places like South Carolina.
Yeah, talk about the power of that momentum. You covered these things so many times that that's what you sort of rely on. If you put a lot of money or you put a lot of just effort in Iowa and you take it seriously, or the voters take you seriously, that it really pays off by giving you a nice boost and a lot of momentum right at the very beginning.
It pays off rather literally, because excitement equals momentum, which equals donors. And going into at the early stage of the game, if you do well in Iowa, you get that big bump, and the dollars start coming into your campaign fund. And I think for Buttigieg, he didn't have a choice but to act like he gave his victory speech. But it seemed like at the end of his speech, what was missing was the word maybe. And it's just a tough position to be in for all of them, and they have no other choice but to move on to New Hampshire and say, we're going to move victoriously on to New Hampshire. But you don't have real numbers, so nothing's concrete.
Did you hear it that way when Mayor Buttigieg said the victorious comment? Some people said maybe he couched it because it's not all in. We don't have all the data, but it does. We are going to New Hampshire victorious, by all indications.
By all indications. I was looking back at my notes to get the quote directly. By all indications. And that's the only time he couched what he was saying. The other thing he says is that we turned improbable into an undeniable reality.
Right.
And that's where it seemed like maybe the word maybe should have been stuck
right
at the end. Poor guy.
So then
he wrote such a good line and he couldn't really use it.
But then you pointed out Bernie Sanders and responded by releasing his internal polls, and they show a really strong, I guess, first place finish for him, too. So they're both sort of claiming victory, I should say.
Yeah, I think for the both of them, it's unfortunate. And I think for the process, of course, you have everybody looking at Iowa saying, all right, that's enough with you guys being number one. And and there's so much criticism of the caucus process. It involves, you know, coin tosses and people standing in corners of rooms. And it's a bit convoluted. And we have the ability now to, I'm not going to say vote with your phones, because that seems to be the heart of the problem.
That's a bad word today. That's a really bad word. No apps, no phones, no technology. They're doing paper counting, Mike. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for checking in with us. And we'll be posted. Stay posted and see what happens. Thank you, Mike Tobin.
My pleasure.
Mike Tobin of the Fox News Channel. He's talking about that measure we've been mentioning here on the show about, do you decide to say Iowa no longer goes first? Let's talk to a reporter, State House reporter, who's covered that beat for quite some time at our NextStar affiliate. She's on the ground in Des Moines, Monica Madden. Monica, you hear all these calls for Iowa to no longer go first. In fact, one of your Des Moines Register political reporters had a column out today, The Death of Iowa. This is really bad.
It's been pretty interesting to unfold. And if I'm talking quiet, it's because I'm in the library at the Capitol right now. That was literally the most quiet place. Of course, as we know, rotundas are pretty echoey. But yeah, I mean, this is my first caucus, so I have a fresh set of eyes covering the Iowa caucuses here. And it seems like in the past, you know, couple of months that we've had this build up to the campaign, so many people talking about, okay, you have, you know, Julian Castro complaining about the Iowa caucuses, you know, criticizing the process and how it goes. And, you know, it's not people saying that it's not inclusive, it's not a fair process, Iowa shouldn't go first. And then, you know, there was a lot of pressure on the Iowa Democratic Party to perform well last night. And as we are seeing, it just is pretty chaotic over here. And, you know, you have to wonder if this will continue in the next 4 years. We just talked to Governor Kim Reynolds here, and she said that she thinks Iowa should still be first. But, I mean, who knows what's going to shake up coming up.
What was the first? I mean, it seemed like I was watching last night to see if any results were coming in, because typically you have these results 10 o'clock the night before. And so it was clear that that didn't happen. They've now isolated it to what? An app that they were using for the first time this year?
Yeah. Okay. So I'll tell you a little bit about the app. So it's interesting because, you know, we're in a digital age. People are impatient. They want results fast. So this app was meant to be kind of a solution for that, for getting those results out in a much faster manner. However, so we have the Iowa Democratic Party telling us that there was an underlying data collected on the smartphone app that they were supposed to use, and that it was only partial data. So that's what caused this giant delay. And they were saying it's accurate, but it was just taking time to bring that all in. We were talking to precinct captains, trying to figure out what happened. And the one I was at, I was in a suburb of Des Moines called Beaverdale. And they were telling me that they couldn't even download the app to begin with, or other people had issues logging in. There was a lot of security, I believe, to get into the app, like a PIN number, and I think there were just too many barriers, so they couldn't even use it. Then you have all these precinct captains in, like, hundreds of caucuses across the state trying to call in as they normally do. But then I think what happened, what seems like it happened, is you had too many people calling in to try to contact the party to where the phone line just blew up.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's what we see, that just overflow. And now they're trying to backtrack and use the paper trail, which they had, because they have people at these caucuses writing down their first choice and second choice on a sheet of paper. So I think
that's what they're doing.
Seeing the delay.
Okay.
Yes, yes. And I believe that was new this year. That was something that precinct captains told me was new, because normally it's just, you know, the crazy head count. You've got everyone in a room. But this time, after they did their first alignments and got together in groups, they were given sheets of paper to write down their preferences. And then the same thing happened for their second alignment.
You know, I just want to ask you, because we only have a minute or two here, but, you know, you're on the ground there. You live in Des Moines. How would you say, as you talk to people who participated in this political process, how are they feeling about all this?
I think there's a little bit of stress with voters because, you know, Iowans have this really unique opportunity in that they have a, you know, first-hand look at the democratic process in selecting the nominee. And they've been really spoiled, honestly. We've been spoiled with having all these candidates coming and pandering to the state and talking to people. And there's so many Iowans who've literally met every single candidate and had conversations with every single candidate. So I think people are kind of feeling worried that this isn't going, this tradition of Iowa coming first and having all these candidates flood our state isn't going to happen anymore.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about earlier. A lot of other states are saying, hey, it's not working out well there. How about over here? You're seeing this as turning into an opportunity for even folks here in Illinois. Our own governor was calling for it, and they seem to like that idea. But do the let me ask you this, though, before we let you go. Do the results get questioned, or do you feel that there is such an attention to accuracy that they now are taking well over 12 hours, you know, coming up on a day and a half later to release these results, that they will be accurate and people will embrace them as such?
It seems like, at least from what we're hearing from the Iowa Democratic Party chair, like, that is why it's taking so long, is they're really making sure that it is meticulous and they're thorough and making sure that these results are accurate. So I think where you get the question of accuracy is when you have all these campaigns now coming out reporting their own results from what they heard from different precincts, and that's where you kind of have the questions. But I think because it's taking so long, I think it will be sound, but, you know, the news cycle is going to move on. We've got the president's State of the Union tonight. All the candidates went to New Hampshire, so by the time we get the results, will it really even have the same impact if it would have been released as planned?
We just have a quick question. 815, what percentage of the Iowa population actually participated in the caucus? Do you have any idea of that number, about what it is? Not to put you on the spot there, Monica.
Do you know? I think I saw something about like 30-something percent. Okay. I'm not sure about that exact number,
but it's low as relative to the overall population.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much, Monica. We appreciate you checking in with us.
Yes, thanks
so much for having me. She's at our Next Star affiliate in Des Moines. Monica Madden is her name. She's the State House reporter. Thanks, Monica. And she mentioned the State of the Union, so we're going to talk to the president's economic advisor, one of them, Stephen Moore. He's going to be joining the show here. So how many times do you think the president will mention the economy tonight in his speech? I think it's a pretty good bet that that will come up. What about jobs and the job picture? Also a good bet, very positive message, and he's got great data to back that up for sure. Do you think he'll mention impeachment? I don't know about that one. We're going to find out a little more, though. Stephen Moore joins us coming up here on WGN Radio. All right, we want to talk because the State of the Union is tonight. The president will talk to the country about where we are, and I'm imagining that jobs and the economy will come up. Stephen Moore is an economist. He's an economic advisor to the president, chief economist for the Heritage Foundation, and a popular television commentator. You see him on the TV all the time, right, Stephen?
Good afternoon. Yeah, big night here in Washington. In a few hours, the president will be going before the country and probably taking a little bit of a victory lap on this strong economy. And it'll be interesting to see whether he brings up the impeachment trial, but he's certainly going to crow about this economy.
Yeah, so what's your bet on first things first, the impeachment? Will he mention it tonight? Will he talk about it, or will he talk about the Democrats in more of a circuitous way? What do you think he's going to do?
Well, you know, I would say that if I were Donald Trump, and as you know, I worked with him in the campaign, so I've gotten to know him very well. I would use this speech, because it's going to have a huge audience, so, you know, American people are going to be watching, to reach across the aisle to the Democrats and say, look, let's work together. Let's put this partisanship behind us and work together to create more jobs and more growth and better trade deals and so on. And if he does that, I think he becomes almost invincible. You know, there was a new poll that came out today. It's ironic that just as this impeachment is coming to an end, his approval rating is higher than it's been any time in 3 years of his presidency. So, and I think that reflects a really, really strong economy. And boy, the stock market's going through the roof again today. There's something really special about this economy today.
You know, it's funny because so many polls right now, Stephen, as you notice, split right down in the middle on almost everything, from whether or not impeachment is warranted or this or that. You name it. However, when it comes to people's view of the president's performance on the economy, it is higher than that. So you're seeing people from the other side come over and say, yep, you know what, I'm going to give him strong marks on that. And you go to Iowa, where it's 2.7% unemployment, even lower than the 3.5% unemployment in our nation. And you think about how that message, it appears to be resonating, appears to be affecting people's lives in a material way.
Well, it is. I mean, we did a study that showed that the average family, I'm talking about median households, people in the very middle, they've seen a $4,000 gain in their income in just 3 years. That's a gigantic increase. I mean, incomes only went up $1,000 in 8 years under Obama. So people are feeling it in the pocketbook. And that's why, by the way, why you see people spending a lot of money. Look at the Christmas season with the huge shopping that went on. You're seeing, by the way, one thing Trump is going to say for sure is that we have the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years, and we have the lowest inflation rate in 50 years. So I don't know if you're old enough to remember under Jimmy Carter when we had the misery index, which was inflation under plus unemployment. At that time, it was like 20%. Now the misery index is like 5%.
What about this whole idea of labor participation? Because I think that's another measure that people are now joining the labor force, who are coming back into jobs, who before had left the workforce and said, hey, you know what, I'm not even in it anymore. We are seeing that's a positive number, too. How important do you think that is?
I think it's a huge one. And in fact, you know, what's going on is that under Obama, we had a reduction in unemployment, but that was because people dropped out of the workforce. And by the way, if you drop out of the workforce and you're not looking for a job, you're not considered unemployed. So we had millions and millions of people drop out of the workforce. Under Trump, we've actually seen not just the lowest unemployment rate, but also a big, big increase by millions of workers that have entered the workforce. By the way, my favorite statistic, I have to, you know, say, is 7 million. Do you know what that number is?
7 million. What could that number be? 7 million. It's not my paycheck. it's probably yours.
Yeah. No, that's Michael Bloomberg's paycheck.
Yeah, right.
No, 7 million is the number of unfilled jobs in the United States today. So for the first time in American history, we have 7 million open jobs. And by the way, there's only 6 million people who are officially unemployed. So I'm not too good at math, but I think I can do this one in my head. If you have 7 million open jobs and 6 million people looking for jobs, even if we put every single American looking for a job into a job, we'd still have a million jobs left over.
Steve, you are very good at math. Weren't you a candidate for like the Fed board? I mean, weren't they looking at you for that whole thing? I mean, come on, you know your math. So what do you do about that problem?
I've been working on my math as a result of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I grew up in Illinois. As you know, I'm a Chicago boy.
I grew up
in the North Shore. And, you know, I had the nuns teach me arithmetic, saints, faith, hope, and charity.
That's one way to do it. But what do you do with those unfilled jobs? What's the proposal there?
Well, you know, that's a great question. Number one, we do have a lot of... We have a lot of Americans that could be and should be working. We need to get kids, especially young people, the skills they need. You know, look, I always tell kids, because I give a lot of talks on high school and college campuses, if you have a degree in psychology or sociology or ethnic studies or something like that, there's not a lot of jobs for that. But if you have any kind of useful skill, if you can be, you know, can you try to get an electrician lately? Or a roofer?
It is hard. I would say you're right. The trades can be tough to get a good person to help you.
Those people are making a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other thing.
Right.
They're making a lot of money for those jobs. You know, you're an electrician, or you're a nursing aide, or you are.
I think we might have lost Steve.
Someone who knows $100,000 a year.
Right. Right. In Chicago, you get a guy, and then you keep your guy happy, and then that's your guy. That's how it works. So then you're just always doing it. But I understand the point you're making, is that you need to attract people with these skills, young people in particular, to go to those professions, because you're right, they pay well, and they're needed. We need them in the economy, for sure. Terry Savage, by the way, says hello. Financial guru Terry Savage. I saw her in the hallway, said, I'm talking to Stephen Moore. She said, tell him I said hello. She also...
I love Terry. I've known her for 20 years. The smartest financial advisor in America is Terry.
And she's a straight talker. I can understand what she says, except on this issue. She said to ask Stephen about China and the impact it's going to have, because China just injected $175 billion of liquidity into their markets after the coronavirus. They were worried about how that would spook the markets and cause financial problems. And so they've done this kind of version of quantitative easing, which we've done here. Europe has done it too. And what impact that has, and should we be worried about our economy being impacted?
Well, I think the big virus we have to worry about from China is the coronavirus. You know, I think that their physical health is a big issue right now, and they covered it up. You know, they didn't take, you know, quick, swift steps to deal with this virus. Now, it looks like there's going to be some kind of vaccine that will contain this. But I think the reason that you're seeing the stall out in their economy, frankly, is because they have this, this virus. And by the way, it makes us really appreciate our public health measures here in the United States and our drug companies. You know, I see the drug companies being villainized all the time. Wait a minute. We need the drug companies to come up with the vaccines to fight these kinds of diseases. But I think China's a bubble economy, actually. They're, you know, command and control. The communists have taken back over. But, you know, and that will have a negative effect, because China's now the second largest economy in the world. But, you know, they need to do, as Trump said when he was out in Davos, Switzerland, the rest of the world has to do what we're doing. Cut taxes, cut regulation, promote energy, and get government off the back of businesses. And you do that, and your economy can fly.
Hey, Stephen, before I let you go, and I appreciate your time, the one thing we have to make sure we get to is the U.S. budget deficit exceeding $1 trillion this year. The Congressional Budget Office put that report out recently. Not typically what you've heard Republican candidates talk about before, not typically what you've heard Republican presidents sort of be proud of. Is this where we need to be?
No, we got to bring down the spending. But I'll tell you this, though, it's something a lot of people don't realize, because I hear the Democrats say, oh, we're running these deficits because of the tax cuts. In 2019, we have more federal tax cuts paid by the American people than any. We do not have a revenue problem, but you know what? We have an overspending in Washington. By the way, you have an overspending problem in Chicago. Springfield, too.
Yes, I would agree with that. I only heard part of your answer there, but I would like you to come back on the show sometime, and we appreciate your time. We are out of time, but we'll be watching the State of the Union tonight. And Stephen Moore, thanks for weighing in here on WGN.
Thank you.
Stephen Moore there again. He's been an economic advisor to President Trump and chief economist at the Heritage Foundation. The Northwestern Newsroom is where we're going to go at the top of the hour to get the news from Steve Bertrand. That's coming up. And also Professor Fraud is here. He's going to let you in on knowing some of the new tech scams, involving your email and your phones. He's got them. He'll tell you about them and how to protect yourself. Coming up here on WGN. It's me, Anna, here in the WGN Skyline Studios, coming up on 2:07, and we want to get to Professor Fraud in a few minutes here, because he's got a number of things to tell us about. Have you heard about the boss scam? Your boss is emailing you, but something's not quite right. Seems like you might be asking you for money, or click on a link, or all the things you're not supposed to do, but because it's your boss, you fall for it. You're like, oh, I got to answer my boss. Well, that's one of the scams he's going to tell us about, and then some other stuff, too, that's going around to put on your radar to protect yourself. Professor Fraud coming up. But we want to talk to first Carter O'Brien is here. He's the sustainability officer at the Chicago Field Museum. And we have tackled this issue before a number of times, and we'll continue to talk about it because we had so many questions last time, recycling and the plastics and where they're going and how a lot of them have been ending up in Lake Michigan. And I think a lot of us are very concerned about Lake Michigan. It is our treasure and we'd like to preserve it. Isn't that right, Carter? That's some of the work that you are doing over at the Field Museum to kind of create partnerships to help preserve it and make that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the Field Museum being on the lakefront with the Shedd Aquarium and Lincoln Park Zoo and the Notobart and all these other, you know, iconic institutions, we're very aware that The impression of litter is just not good for us as cultural destinations, but you know, we also participate in beach cleanups and do other things where, you know, we're essentially just trying to make the environment look as pristine as possible. But
right.
we know what's getting in there. And the real challenge that I think everyone has started to embrace that is serious and needs to be done something with is the fact that plastic is light and it's loose. And when it gets discarded, it blows all over the place. And it often just ends up kind of working its way down where it ends up in the rivers, on the riverbanks.
That was the number one question, though, Carter, was from our listeners who said, well, how does it get in the water? What can I do? How do we prevent this from happening? Because there are microplastics that break down. You can't see them anymore, but they're there.
Yes.
And they're making their way into our water supply and food supply.
Yeah. So
fish.
We would like to, you know, reduce the use of single-use plastics for sure. We would like to just find better substitutes for them so that they are people are encouraged to, you know, bring their own water bottle. Bring your own sort of flatware, use compostable products whenever they're available. And something we're also working on across the state is the idea of a container deposit law, so we could finally get Illinois on the same track Michigan, Oregon, California, New York, some of these states are, where they see anywhere from 50 to 90% redemption rates. And so what that would do, I think, for us here in the city is if you've ever been to Grant Park after a huge event and you just see all of those loose plastic water bottles everywhere, trash can gets bumped over, you know, they blow all over the place. It's a very windy place on the lakefront. I think if you were able to put some sort of deposit on that, you would find that they would get picked up immediately.
That's not a bad idea. So that's something you're working on. You said that you had an interesting thing to make us really, it's food for thought, literally, about plastics and how much is ending up in our systems.
Yes. So they did a peer-reviewed study last year, and they found out that taking a look at, I think it was about 50 different scientific studies, that when you put all the totals together, that we are all essentially consuming 5 grams of plastic a week, which is basically a credit card.
A credit card a week is what we're consuming.
Credit card a week, yes.
In plastics.
In plastics. And it's invisible. It's coming in through the drinking water. It's coming in our food. I don't even think that number accounts for what they think is coming in the respiratory systems, because it's broken down and then it's getting into your lungs.
Yeah, this all sounds
very scary.
Terrible and scary, but I think that this is why we want to get involved before things get worse and to try to correct some of the problems we have. Are there things we should know about going on in terms of trying to tackle this problem and help us for the future?
Yeah, so, you know, for sure, there's the Chicago Public Schools have really made a lot of progress in recent years. They have a fantastic contract that they set up where back before the price of recyclables had kind of dropped quite a bit, they were actually funding some innovative composting programs at the schools with some rebates they got back. And so even though the price of recycling as a commodity has dropped at the moment, it's a cycle. It'll come back. And what we really like about the public schools effort is that, you know, you're putting some effort into the kids and then the kids are going to take it home. And everybody who has kids know that there's nothing they love more than catching, you know, the parent doing something wrong.
Oh, gosh.
My daughter lives for this.
It's, so true. How old is your daughter?
14.
Okay. Does it get worse or better? Mine's 8, so.
They get smarter.
Yeah, they pick up
it's
on everything.
It's kind of scary.
Yeah. So she tells it, because they know, the kids do know the recycling. They know this stuff, and they'll tell you.
Yep. It's ingrained, you know, as soon as they start, which is fantastic. And, you know, really the challenge in Chicago, I think, is we just had kind of this broken system, this blue bag system, which was unique to Chicago I think we had it up for 15 years or something like that. And
how did that go, the whole blue bag system?
Absolutely terrible. I mean, it's possible that they were recovering some of it, but it was all being done by hand. And so that's just not the most efficient way to do things. And the real problem, I think, was just the faith in the system where, you know, people that were putting the recycling in these blue bags, they just watched it get thrown into a garbage truck. And, you know, the bag gets ripped. And it's not a lot of solace to these folks when somebody says, don't worry, when it gets to the facility, we'll sort it out, because they see, you know, the back of the truck and they're thinking, oh, no way. Like that's
right.
That's
it does, you lost a little faith in the system when you just see everything going into one spot.
Yeah.
But we're trying to improve that as well, because, again, we don't have very good recycling rates in the city of Chicago. 9% is where it is, which pales in comparison to other big cities. So big initiatives to try to improve where we stand. Where can people go to find out more about you, Carter, and what you're doing over at the Field Museum and these sustainability efforts?
Sure. If you go to fieldmuseum.org and you do a search for sustainability or recycling, you'll find the work we're doing at the museum. And, you know, we like to say that Our recycling rate was about 17% as recently as 7 years ago. And since then, last year, we were 62%. So
at the field?
Yeah. So when you really focus on it, you can make a difference very, very quickly. And for us, getting rid of the single-use plastics in our restaurants to a great degree. I mean, I think
you're on board with that proposal.
It works.
Okay. All right. That's what the Alderman Wagasback has proposed. And yes. we'll see what happens there. But Carter O'Brien, Sustainability Officer, Chicago Field Museum, thank you for sharing your thoughts on recycling and all things about sustainability.
Thank you.
We have Professor Broad coming up here with us to discuss the scams that we've been mentioning throughout the show today, including the phony phone call scam, the bogus boss scam, and the tech non-support scam. Those are on the list. There's some others, too, and you'll want to know about these coming up here on WGN. All right, this is the moment we've been waiting for. Professor Fraud is here. And Professor Fraud, you always come armed with all these things that freak me out, but also help protect me. So that's what I love about our visits. And you sent over an email to me and said, hey, Anna, do you know about these scams? And I said, no, I don't. But I think I could potentially be a victim of them. Let's start with the bogus boss scam.
Bogus boss. Yeah, this one has really been blowing up. It was estimated last year something like $10 billion could have been lost in this scam.
And how's it work?
It always comes, you get an email or a text early in the morning when you're on your way to work, supposedly from your boss. And your boss is saying, I need you to do a big favor for me. We've got some big clients coming in right now, and I want to give them each a gift card. So stop at a store, Walgreens, CVS, whatever, and pick up, you know,
$25 gift cards, or $50.
Usually it's like $100, $200,
ooh,
you know, more.
Ooh.
And then you say, oh, sure, boss, I'll, you know, and text me when you're done. Okay, I've got them. Oh, it turns out we need more. Stop at another store, but this time pick up some Amazon cards for $100 each. A local TV station last night had a story of a woman out in Palos Hills who spent $5,000.
Oh, no.
Buying these gift cards, comes into work, and, well, before she gets to work, she says, okay, I'm on my way in. And they say, well, tell you what, I need to put together a spreadsheet. Scratch off the number, the pin on the back, and take a picture, because it's using your smartphone, take a photo of all the cards and send those photos to me.
Gee.
And you just gave them the keys to the kingdom.
So now they have the $5,000 they spend immediately.
She recovered, I think they were able to stop like $300 worth. Everything else got spent. And so she walks into the boss's office, got your gift cards.
Oh.
Yeah.
And he's like, didn't order any gift cards. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Now, the reason this is so compelling, I think, is because this seems fairly sophisticated, as so many of these new ones are, where they actually have the name of your boss. And the email looks like, so let's say it's John Taylor, john.taylor@... And so if you don't really take a look at that to make sure it is your company, is that part of it?
Yeah. Well, a lot of it has to do with here in the U.S., a lot of websites will have people's, their titles and their email addresses. And now in Europe, that's forbidden. That's considered privacy. It's not allowed. And they don't have
your email public. They have
your email address public, right. But here, so you can go on there, get the names of the bosses, and then they can create a lookalike email. So just, you know, say it's, to make up a name, John Smith at WGN Radio. Okay. They would have johnsmith.wgnradio@gmail.com. It's free for them to set it up, but because on your cell phone you only see the first few letters, they see John Smith, WGN Radio. Well, that's my boss.
And it's your boss, so there's an urgency to it in most cases. You have to kind of answer that.
Or they set up, use the boss's name at Gmail, and the first line they tell you is, this is my personal email address. I'm on my way to work right now. That's why I'm not using the office email. That's what they used on my wife. My wife got one of these early morning. She was commuting to downtown Chicago. I happened to be in the car with her.
So they did not know what they were dealing with there. This is Professor Fraud's wife. She's not going to be like involved in a scam.
We kept that guy on the line for about an hour.
Yeah. That's some people find fun in that.
We had great fun, you know, making up excuses for why we couldn't get it. And, you know, she's like, you know, she's getting these, you know, responses like, you are a terrible employee. Oh, I will have you fired if you don't get this. And we're just laughing, you know.
Pretty amazing. So our guest is William Bill Cressy at Governor State University. We know him as Professor Fraud because he's on top of all the scams. One thing that seems to be fairly consistent in a number of scams, and my cousin Bridget just fell for this, and I got an email from her, the gift card thing. That's the new thing. They ask for a gift card rather than cash or bank account information, because it feels as if that's maybe people are a little less likely to give out the bank account information. They've heard a lot about those scams, and they know that you shouldn't do that. But the gift card thing is what they've asked for, a number of different scams are asking for.
Right. So much so that a lot of stores, CVS, Walgreens, I've noticed at the cashier, they'll have a sign. If you're buying a gift card, please know who you're giving it to, and they're actually, that you're not being taken in by a fraud. Because as soon as they get those gift card numbers and the PIN, they're at the store, they've cashed it in, and it's gone. And you're not going to recover.
And it's hard to trace those kinds of things.
Right. They can trace it back to a store, and it's like, okay, somebody walked in here. Best Buy seems to be a popular one. Somebody walked in, bought a big screen TV, and they're gone, and that's it. So, the gift card is big. What's incredulous sometimes is kind of tied into one of the other frauds, the phony phone call fraud.
Okay, what's that?
You get a phone call from someone identifying themselves as, the most popular is probably Internal Revenue Service, state police. I've heard the jury department, the Circuit Court of Cook County, or the federal court, or whatever, saying that you failed to appear for her jury service, or we have a lien against you, or we have a warrant for your arrest, and we're coming to get you unless you can post bail right now. And you post bail using a Apple gift card or a Google gift card or an Amazon gift card. Well, okay, folks, Professor Fraud here to tell you, no, the FBI does not accept Apple gift cards to pay bail. Okay, they do not.
Yeah, it's tough, because in retrospect, I guess, it is amazing that people do. They're sophisticated enough that people will fall for it or think it's real. Or, you know, you're dealing with so much noise in your life that if the IRS calls, you think, oh, okay, oh my gosh, is there something? I don't know. And you want to act. It's that urgency that they're creating around it, which also should give you pause.
Right. And this also is, you know, they sometimes use, email or text, in which case they put the symbols of the FBI, or I've even seen one where they will send what looks like a warrant for your arrest, you know, on the official stationery with all the, you know, like, oh boy, I better pay up now. And again, the instructions are, you know, go to Walgreens or CVS and buy $2,000 worth of gift cards and send us the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, if they're really going to arrest you, they don't call you in advance. Okay. They come and arrest you. You know, the IRS doesn't like, oh, let's give them an opportunity to leave. You know, they don't do that. They come and get you. But secondly, they do not accept gift cards, you know, in lieu of bail. You know, they prefer, you know, checks and cash.
Yeah. If people have questions for Professor Fraud, he can answer them. 312-981-7200. And I have a question, because I was in a store over the weekend, and it was a store that you have a private credit card for. So, you have all your different credit cards.
Right.
And they asked me, I didn't have it with me, and I had a return. So they asked me, will you put in your social security number, and then we'll look it up for you. I said, oh, I have my ID. And they said, no, we have to have your social security. I said, well, can I give you other credit cards or other forms? No, we need to have your social security number. And I thought, okay, should any of us at any store where they need to look you up in that way, or maybe any type of business, would you give that?
I understand what the store is trying to do. They want to verify that you are that person, and their basis is the Social Security number. I would feel a lot more comfortable if they would ask you for the last four digits of the Social Security number, in which case maybe in their system, maybe there's one, two, or three others with those last four digits. In which case, then they should then ask for some secondary backup, say your, five-digit zip code or something like that that can, you know, hone in on you. I'm uncomfortable when anybody asks for the full 9-digit Social Security number because, again, that's the key to the kingdom, to stealing your identity, to applying for credit at other places. I've seen people using that information to buy houses. They go out and get a mortgage claiming they are you and buy a house.
Gee, that's hard to get out of. But then once they have a house, isn't that traceable?
It is. Once, if you know that they've done that. I had one case where they didn't know that suddenly their credit score dropped a few points. Okay, but they kept paying on the mortgage.
Mm.
So the people just were living there, but identified as you. And it wasn't until they tried buying a summer house.
Oh, another house. They were ready to do that.
That their credit was so bad that they said, no, we're not going to give it because you've got that other one, you know, 5 miles away. And they're like,
yeah.
And they went to the door of the house and met the people.
Oh.
Yeah. And
were they pleasant? Did they invite them in for coffee?
They were pleasant and they worked it out. But that's one of the few cases where that will actually happen.
Oh, that's exactly right. 708, thanks. You just reminded me I need to call Hertz Rent-A-Car. Our bank information was compromised and people rented a car. I'm now getting information sent to my house about them with the crook's name on it under Hertz, most valuable renter on it. How dumb can somebody be? Yeah, so hopefully they're dumb, but the whole point of what you're talking about is these are getting more and more sophisticated all the time.
They are, because as I like to use as a motto, fraud never sleeps, because with the beauty of the internet and the convenience of the internet, while we are awake here or when we are asleep here, there's someone on the other side of the globe who's working on the internet to separate you from your money.
Yeah, and you got to be careful. Yeah. Professor Fraud, I hope you come back and keep us posted on all scams. Like, they're always on your radar, and so thanks for putting him on our radar.
Well, I'd love to come back.
William Bill Cressy is his real name. Governor State University.
Yes.
Professor Fraud, you can find him on Twitter at Professor Fraud or Prof. Fraud.
Well, Professor Fraud on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube. Haven't gotten the Instagram yet.
No, you're not there yet?
Launched.
Snapchat?
Yeah.
No, not Snapchat.
Not Snapchat.
TikTok, that's where all the cool kids are now, at least if you're 14.
yeah, exactly. When I start appealing to that crowd, maybe.
I think we're all going to stay away from TikTok.
I'm
trying to get my daughter to stay away from TikTok.
Yeah,
so that's
a good idea.
Separate issue entirely.
Yeah.
Thank you, Professor. Good seeing you.
Great
more to come here on WGN. Our next guest is Representative Ann Williams, and she's from the 11th District, which includes some of the western suburbs, Aurora, Naperville, Bolingbrook. She's also considered one of the leaders, not only in Illinois, but across the nation, really, when it comes to protecting people's privacy, protecting your data, and passed some pretty important, meaningful stuff here in Illinois that took effect earlier this year. Illinois now has one of the strictest biometric privacy laws in the nation. What does that mean? What is biometric privacy? Let's ask her. Representative Williams, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me today, Anna.
So you've been out front on this whole thing. You've been really leading and saying, hey, we need to have these kinds of laws in place to protect people. What is it you're doing with the biometric privacy? Tell people what that means and how you're protecting.
Sure. Well, Illinois has long been a leader in terms of privacy on the issue of the usage of biometrics. So biometrics are things like your fingerprint, facial recognition technology, a retina scan. In 2008, Illinois decided to make sure that a company could not use this information without a person's consent and knowledge that they were using it.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating because we do just sort of give out that stuff. It feels like you put it on your phone. If they ask you, put your face everywhere. It feels as if more and more places are requiring this kind of biometric data. But who uses it and who gets to buy it from whom after that? That is the piece of it you were trying to regulate, trying to look at and say this can't be just circulating all over the place.
Well, yeah, you're right about that. And Illinois actually had a lot of foresight when they passed this law in 2008. Because in 2008, there was no way we could understand how far technology would advance to the point now where there are apps and technology out there that can scan your data from photos, from anywhere on social media, put them in a database, and basically you lose your anonymity as a person walking down the street. The technology is advancing so fast, the law is really having a hard time keeping up with it, frankly.
You know, and that's the interesting part, because this fight for privacy back then, you just referenced 2008, it had to go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, handing down this landmark decision about what the Illinois General Assembly had said for years. Regardless of how technology advances, and we know it's moving so quickly, it is hard to keep up with exactly what's happening with our data and our all of it. But every individual has a right to privacy, was what they decided. And you think about it, a cell phone follows you through everywhere, from your residence to your doctor's office to your, you know, political headquarters, wherever you go, and keep so much data on you. To say nothing at that time, even when you pass this, about biometric data, you weren't really even using that then.
You're totally right on with that. It's amazing. We used to worry about cameras, fixed cameras, monitoring what people were doing. Then it became drones, you know, able to get large swaths of data with one, you know, flyover. And now we're walking around with our own personal surveillance device, our phones, which we use all the time. And often the apps on our phones are collecting data on our location, personal preferences, all day long, and we don't even know. And there's not even an awareness that these apps are designed strictly for that reason.
How do you get in front of this? How do you continue to stay in front of technology and protect people?
Well, you know, it's very difficult. The technology is really advancing so quickly, and there's nothing wrong with technology. Technology, when used responsibly, is a great thing. We all take advantage of it every day. The challenge is balancing privacy interests with that technology. I'll give you one example. I passed a bill a few years ago, and it was called the Geolocation Privacy Protection Act. It was so simple. All it did is say that if an app on your phone was collecting your location data and sharing it, selling it, whatever, aggregating it, monetizing it, that you had to let someone know. Obviously, when we use Uber or Lyft or something, we know they're collecting our data because they have to find us to pick us up. But there's so many more apps on your phone that deal with things like fitness or weather or, you know, golf tip of the day, for example, that really are all about collecting data, and most people don't realize that. The bill we passed would require those apps to let people know they're collecting that data, but it was vetoed by the prior governor, and we have not been able to pass it since.
Yeah, well, maybe that's something that you'll take up in the upcoming session. You know, it's interesting because you look back and you think WeWork was sued under the Illinois Biometric Privacy Law. WeWork, of course, a place where people go. You work there, and you have small companies that grow there, and people interact with each other in a shared working environment. And they were using facial scans to track people as they walked around their shared spaces. So part of the law you're talking about in Illinois said that you have to give consent. If companies are going to start using your facial scan and track you wherever you go, you need to give consent. How does that happen? They have to tell you, submit something to you, and let you know, hey, we're tracking you, right?
Exactly. You know, biometric technology, it needs even more protection than regular data you collect on someone. So you can change a password, or if you have an account breached, for example, but you have one fingerprint, one face, one retina, and once that information is out there, if it's not stored or shared responsibly, you're in trouble. And there's, you know, you can't replace it. You can't change the password. You can't fix it. So there's a lot of damage that can happen if people don't handle biometric data responsibly. And what we found, at least in terms of passing legislation, is that the data companies, since my bill was originally passed and vetoed, they have doubled down on their efforts to lobby against these laws. They want to go ahead, collect your data without your knowledge, without your consent. They're making billions and billions of dollars with this almost new shadow economy of data collection, and they are fighting hard in Springfield and capitals across the country to make sure laws are not passed, which would impede their efforts to, you know, make a ton of money from our data.
Well, you have a Democratic supermajority in the state house. Well, don't you think something like this, you'd be able to get your colleagues on board?
Well, I would hope so. But again, the big tech companies come out with all kinds of arguments like, oh, if you protect privacy, you're going to stifle innovation. This is much too expensive to regulate the use of data. They say it should be done on the federal level. Sure, but it's not happening on the federal level. So they have every excuse in the books, and they, frankly, out-resource us and outspend us when it comes time to advocacy. So that's why I'm thrilled to be on the show today, to ask your listeners to weigh in with their state legislators, because the battle really is on the state level on these issues.
You know, it's I think in the new frontier, and maybe I'm late to the game on this. I probably am because all things technology move so quickly. Is our health data? Our health data, keeping that private. Many of us might have seen that story about Google gathering our personal health data on Americans without consent, and that was just part of what was allowed to do as a technology company that partnered with medical systems. And I think then it starts to become, it feels even more intrusive. And I know we're supposed to accept, well, is privacy dead? I mean, should our health records actually be viewed and out there and stored and traded or sold? That doesn't seem right.
It sure doesn't. You're right on. And we assume, most people assume, that somewhere this data is regulated and these companies are legally obligated to treat our data with respect and care. And the scary thing is that's just not the case. It's a free-for-all out there when it comes to data. It's the Wild West. These companies are not regulated, and they're pushing the envelope as far as they go and waiting for some legal action to happen. And that's why I was thrilled to see the Facebook lawsuit or the Facebook settlement this week, because it sent a strong message to these companies. If you violate the law, you will be held accountable.
Yeah, that's that $500 million, $550 million settlement for Illinois from Facebook, because they were using facial recognition and tagging people and what, tracking people? Was that it?
They used facial recognition to tag, which was against the Illinois law that we're discussing today. The difference is, in Illinois, we have this incredibly strong law to protect our biometric data. This is the only state in the country that has as strong of a law. So people that had the same thing happen in neighboring states don't have any recourse. And that's why we protect this act, you know, as like it's the crown jewel. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, every year, this act, they call it BIPA for short, is under attack, and it's all we can do to hang on.
Yeah, and I know that settlement, people were asking before, if you're eligible for something from that, you would be notified, and I think it's about $200 per person, but there's still a federal judge approval and all that kind of thing. I just want to ask you finally, if you put your face out there, though, on Facebook, wouldn't you assume that it's just going to be used and, you know, in that way? Is there some sort of agreement when you just put your photo onto Facebook?
You know, I think it's a matter of awareness and accountability. Whether it's your photo on Facebook, or if you're shopping on a certain site, or you're entering your calories for the day on an app, or whatever you're doing, you know, on your phone, there's a basic assumption that you're kind of doing it for yourself or using the app for what its intended purposes is. What we don't know oftentimes is that data is being used, collected by companies, aggregated, sold to companies to market right back to you. So even though it feels like it's proprietary, like it's your information, companies are making billions of dollars on it. Shouldn't we have a say, or at least an awareness, that it's being used that way?
Well, that's the thing. The California law is just that they have to tell you if a company's going to use it, and if you want to opt out, then you should be able to opt out. That's what they've passed. I know you're looking at things that to make it safer for people in Illinois, mm-hmm. and I appreciate you coming on the show today. State Representative Ann Williams, thank you so much from the 11th
District. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Good to talk with you. We've got trending topics coming up here on the show, including the new Portillo's food truck. You hear about that? And the marijuana bus tours coming to Chicago. It's happening next on WGN. All right, this is the time on the show when we talk about trending topics, what people are sharing and caring about. And I just noticed, as Steve Bertrand and Lauren Lapka step into the studio here to talk trending topics, the mayor just tweeted a photo of her. She's in Washington. She's for the State of the Union address with Tammy Baldwin. How about that?
Oh, okay.
So we've had,
in a way, both senators from Wisconsin on today, because John Williams talked to Ron Johnson earlier.
So they're all sort of, you know, they're getting to hang out a little bit. We'll see what happens there. State of the Union tonight. Hopefully we'll get those Iowa results. What, about an hour away, right?
Partial results. Partial results.
Oh.
And I think maybe a majority, but I don't know.
How do you give partial results? I don't know how you even trust the process now. I mean, I know the time taken to make sure that this is going to be correct seems like it would be reassuring, but I don't think it is.
Yeah, I'm not as worried about. I mean, I think they've got paper. I think they're being super cautious. That's why it's delayed. So I'm not worried about the number, but yeah, I agree, Anna. What's the point of releasing a partial count? Because unless that tells us who won, it tells us nothing. Right. I mean,
what does a partial vote count look like? I mean, just one person.
They might say half the precincts, or Well, we're working on the other half, but here's how it's going so far.
Oh, my gosh. It's just, oh, my gosh.
But I just think of, you know, all of the work put into that. And again, it was all about, it was all put into that state just for that 30-minute speech at the end, you know, to propel the people who did well. And it just didn't happen.
There's no propelling happening. They're all in New Hampshire now. The candidates.
You're right, exactly.
They've moved on. We're still waiting. We'll wait. We'll get it. And we'll have it to bring it to you here on WGN, sure, our news department, well on top of all those things. All right, guys, other things trending. Portillo's has a new food truck. How about that?
How about that?
I'd like to have the Portillo's food truck pull up. Wouldn't that be cool?
I wonder how far it's willing to go, because the times I've lived out of state, I was desperate for Portillo's.
What a good idea. You're absolutely right.
Are they going to bring the 18-year-olds to guide traffic around the food truck?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, they guys,
this one is going state to state. You're supposed to go on and vote where you want it to show up. And it's even going to go to big sporting events like the Indy 500, the Kentucky Derby, could go as far as Miami. So, yeah, you're supposed to go online and vote where you want it to go.
Genius. That's genius.
I couldn't think of this 5 years ago.
Gosh. When you were,
yeah, right. When I was out of
state. Where was that when I was in school? Where was that? It's the second most important vote you'll make in 2020. It's up to you to decide. I see it here, where the Portillo's food truck should serve up its hot dogs, Italian beef, and cheese fries next. What a good idea. They do things right over there at Portillo's. They really do. This one also, how about this? Would you take this? Everyone's friendly, everyone's high. Marijuana tour buses begin rolling into Chicago with a stop at your private bring-your-own smoking lounge.
Dude, yeah, they reversed the river. Look at it.
Talk about combine it with the architectural tour.
Can you believe it? Man.
Yeah, that building I built. No, I didn't. Yeah, that could be very interesting. They say this, so they have a tour guide and they do the whole thing and they teach you the proper way to smoke with a bong and all kinds of things, pipes if you prefer. I don't know. This is what's going on.
Wow.
There's a woman and her mom and her grandma who went on this trip and they talk about it.
Three generations of
Chicago Tribune. Yeah. There you go. That's happening. And so, yeah, that's happening. Chicago has the most romantic restaurants in the United States, according to Open Table. How about that? They went through and they asked people to rank in their reviews.
So there's three different branches of Portillo's? Is that what they are?
Yeah, really. Portillo's is very romantic. Gotta like the Portillo's. But these are more the fancy places mostly make the list. Gibson's Italia, Maple and Ash, RPM Italian, RPM Steak. And then you've got the places like Girl and the Goats, longtime Stephanie Izard chef, you know, top chef restaurants. Cafe Baba Reba, longtime staple in the Lincoln Park neighborhood. That's on here. The Tapas restaurant, popular Vietnamese spot, Le Colonial. And then the West Loop place, ABBA, too, that's got that big open patio, too.
I guess I'm not surprised. We already have the best restaurants in the country, so why wouldn't we have the most romantic?
Yeah, that's so true. It goes hand in hand. Lombard location, the only suburban one, Capital Grill, that made the list. So that's that. Chicago is also home to two of the country's top three hotels. The Four Seasons Hawaii is number one in the list, in case you're wondering. But here in Chicago, the two that make the list, the Langham and the Peninsula.
I know where the Peninsula is. I don't know where the Langham is.
Right by the Trump. You go over on the Wabash.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
It's right there. It cuts through. I think John and the folk, LF, producer LF, were talking about it earlier because they were talking about places to get tea, high tea.
Well, I was part of that conversation, yeah.
And you were lost, as I recall.
I just didn't really know what I hear people go for tea, and I didn't really quite know what that is because I read a lot of British fiction, and they'll refer to tea sometimes as a lunch or something.
Yeah, I think in Britain they do it at like 4 o'clock, 3, 4 o'clock. But here it's just, I think it's a very festive thing that people do around the holidays. We always do that.
Go out for tea?
Yeah, you go out for tea, whether it's one of the big hotels, wherever, and they just, it's just a very fun event.
More
you know?
Of like a drinking experience rather than picking up a coffee or sitting at a bar.
Yeah, and you get your little tea cakes and scones and, you know, little sandwiches and stuff, and it's kind of fun.
Do you eat with your fingers?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah, you get little cucumber sandwiches.
That, yeah.
Yeah, you'd like it. You can ask for more sandwiches too, pro tip. You know, they just give you a few and then you'd be like, I need a few more, and they'll bring them to you. They'll bring them, just so you know. Because so, a guy like you would eat more than they'd bring to the table, so you'd have to do that. Hooters to donate percentage of Chicago wing sales in February to Holy Family School. During the entire month of February, Hooters will donate 1/3 of all their chicken wing sales to the school, and it's a Wings for Kids program. So when you eat there, you're doing good.
You eat those with your fingers, too.
Oh, good. I like this segment.
That's what you do. Yeah, it's all food-related, except I'm going to take that one out of the pack because that's coronavirus-related, and that doesn't follow just as well. We have some audio on this one, too. And Andy Samberg and Jimmy Fallon, they put forward this catchy little tune to it is catchy. It's a great way to start off your day if you want to listen to it. They're both uber-talented, and here's what they came up with.
I kick it. That's kicking way up high. Our shoes don't touch down. Since we were babies, we've been kicking up a storm. We started kicking before we were born. Our feet.
All right, I think we've heard it now. It's like 70s inspired. They're wearing their flared out jumpsuits and the shaggy wigs and stuff. They're talking about how you do the high kick. Can you do the high kick, Lauren?
Okay.
I used to be able to after gymnastics and cheerleading for so many years. I don't know if I could do it anymore. It's been a while since I've stretched.
You got to watch them do it. Andy Samberg and Jimmy Fallon doing the high kick.
Can they kick over a plate of burgers or something at the end of this?
I think that they're not particularly like great at high kicking, right, but they're having fun doing it. That's what's sort of, you know, kind of fun about watching it. So check it out. It's good. The lyrics all kind of rhyme and are really cute. You know, Andy Samberg really has come up with some fun ones. Remember?
I like him. Yeah, I'm a big fan of his.
From his Lazy Sunday one back in the day.
Yeah, so Lonely Island is still a group of theirs. Really? They still have what they would call, you know, a group. So they put out a lot of funny parody songs all the time.
Yeah, and finally, we'll end on this. It's somewhat heartbreaking, but it's definitely making news. A lot of people talking about this today. Actress Shannon Doherty from 90210 fame talks about how her cancer is back as stage 4. It's really quite sad. Here she is on Good Morning America today. Jazz, we have audio on that. She basically is just talking about how she's opening up on the diagnosis and that she thought she had beat it, and then it came back stage 4, so she's fighting the good fight, but it didn't. You know, that it is what it is. Here she is talking. We do have that sound for you from Good Morning America.
Because I thought, well, this will, when I finally do come out, it will have worked 16 hours a day, and it'll be a good, people can look at that and say, oh my God, yeah, she can work, and other people with stage 4 can work too. Like, you know, our life doesn't end the minute we get that diagnosis. We still have some living to do.
Yeah, she learned her cancer had come back aggressively right before Luke Perry's February death, so super sad. And she's suing the insurance company in the case, so now it was going to come public as a result of that lawsuit. So she said, why don't I come out and just
do it
talk
on her own terms,
yeah.
Sort of? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
So we wish her the best to Shannon Doherty. All right, that'll wrap up Trending Topics. Right now, it is 2:55 here on WGN, and we're going to check in with Rokan, see what's coming up on his show, and then get the news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.